Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. Uh-oh, I hear you listeners saying, Guillaume is hosting. What's wrong?
What sort of cataclysm has happened that John can't pinch host? It must be something really bad.
No, it's all good. So this is Thursday, April 18th. This is episode 619. And John is away. He's got some friends visiting his town, and so he's entertaining them. And we decided to let him in the spirit of, the long weekend and Easter. And James, on the other hand, didn't really have anything except that tonight being tonight. Like, he's decided to... just spend the evening reading the scriptures. So
reading the scriptures while watching the Capitals, presumably.
So it's just Greg and I, and we're going to launch right into it before I start messing up. Oh, I guess let's do like the kind of the additional business first. So we're still recording despite just being a duo tonight because we thought it would be a good idea to remind people. To remind listeners that we have a retroactive.
Some people see it that way, from what I've seen.
This is why I wanted to, just launch into new business right away, because there's fewer...
To avoid this.
Exactly. So we have
But think about it this way, you'll be sleepier by the end. So it's actually more likely to happen. That's what I have to think about with the music, but, it's always at the end.
Yeah. So we have a retroactive coming up. People have voted, the people have spoken, and they chose The Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks. And there are two main ways to play this game. One would be to just get the physical copy and play it on a DS or 3DS or 2DS or... No, wait. Actually, that one is wrong.
No. I'm playing my European copy of Spirit Tracks on my Japanese 2DS.
Oh, okay.
Just because I feel like it. But also, it is kind of... I've said before, the nice thing about the 2DS not being a clamshell, even though I do like the clamshell thing in general for the DS family of systems and whatnot, is just that you can sort of support the weight more evenly in your hand, right, kind of thing. So I thought I'd try that for playing something like Spirit Tracks. And I've made a start. I'm not terribly far, but I'm getting there.
Cool. So, okay. So people can play on their 2DSs if they have them. And the other main way would be if you have a Wii U, if it's still plugged in, or if you can easily just hook it back up, you can get it on the eShop for a, cool $10 Canadian, probably cheaper in the US. So it's perhaps not super ideal. That's the way I'm playing it. And, if you choose the kind of the sideways gamepad option,
no flip grip, obviously, there's nothing, have to be a very chunky version to accommodate the gamepad.
Yeah, so if you're holding it that way and you choose the right-handed option, and I'm right-handed, you get to hold the gamepad with your left hand and you have the benefit of that kind of handle-like protrusion on the back of the gamepad to better hold the gamepad in book mode or in tablet mode.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that way, your stylus hand kind of gets in the way of the mic. And this is a very blowing into the mic heavy game.
Especially for a 2009 game.
Yeah.
Of a 4-5 thing. In general, but yeah, this was kind of the last hurrah for mic blowing, as I recall, anyway.
Yeah, and people have like all sorts of little tips, like, oh, you can just like rub the mic port on the DS, and that works just fine. But it didn't seem to work that fine.
Yeah, it's kind of on the side of a 2DS, the mic. Yeah. So yeah, that's what I've done. It's just like give it a little scratch.
Right, but the mic is not. It's kind of discreet on the Wii U gamepad, and so I'm not sure. I haven't been able to do that. So I flipped the orientation, pretended I'm left-handed, but I'm just holding the gamepad the other way. And so I don't have the benefit of the handle anymore, but at least I can blow more easily in the mic. So those are your options. I would suggest if you can find a cheap copy of Spirit Tracks and play in an actual DS, maybe that's the way to go. But otherwise, the Wii U gamepad, it's kind of cool. I'm kind of glad that I at least got to try one DS port that way.
I guess it's because it isn't very button-driven, the fact that I don't think you have any like customizable button mappings with the 3DS Virtual Console, DS Virtual Console, inexplicably, because the other ones do on Wii U. You know, that was kind of like one of the upgrades over Wii Virtual Console, was the completely kind of customizable button mappings for a lot of the systems, but not for DS for whatever reason. But you only need one button for this.
Right. Yeah, and I haven't tried to customize but I'll take your word for it that you can't.
I'm going by James, because I remember he talked about playing Star Fox Command, I think.
Oh, right.
Because I have not really got DS Virtual Console games. I got 3D Picross, but that's, again, heavily touch-driven. It's not really that big of a thing with the buttons.
And you can display the two screens side by side. It doesn't affect
the game. Yeah, it's got so many options for display. Not just like the portrait or the tarte mode or whatever, but this one bigger than the other, or I think it's 8 or something. So, it's really customizable in some ways, and then like weirdly not in others.
Yeah, and of course, like in Spirit Tracks, the side by side screens would not make sense. But yeah, like it's anyway, it's a compromised way to play it, but it's not as bad as as maybe you might fear, but it's not the best. So people should start playing that if they haven't already. And I forget what date James said that we would have the actual retroactive.
Yeah, nothing's that solid yet.
No,
it's not imminent anyway.
Yeah, several weeks from now. This is a long game, but get started. The other piece of business before new business is that people decided that I have found myself a catchphrase. Big fans of the thing that I blurted out when Spirit Tracks was revealed. I'm happy to announce that I have a new catchphrase. And it is, of course, all aboard, gentlemen. Anyway,
choose you.
I use the maybe cruder language, but again,
I want the proper Ralph Wiggum version. I demand nothing less.
I choose not to repeat the words that I said last week, given again that this is a special weekend where our Lord came back to save us. So
he didn't die for your potty mouth, is that what you're saying?
Exactly, yes. And as you know, I'm very devout, and yes.
Yep.
Anyway, this is getting tasteless, so let's go to new business. And Greg, if you would do the honors.
Yeah, so we'll start with the Smash 3.0 update. Is out apparently overnight. Well, over here, the update went out overnight, and apparently there were issues everybody trying to download it at once. And Nintendo's evidently, with all that subscriber money for Nintendo Switch Online, has not massively upgraded their infrastructure to the point that it can handle everyone going, well, not even everyone, because like I said, a decent amount of the world was asleep at the time,
right.
But many people simultaneously try to update Smash for the 3.0 version, and of course Joker for those who either purchased him individually or have got the whole fighter pass for the 5 that are going to come out, and they had the video, I think, went up a day before, kind of revealing all his moves and the final smash and the memento stage and all that. And in that they mentioned, I think, February 2020 as the you know, kind of end date for the fighter pass stuff. So, you know, I guess the four other fighters are going to be coming, you know, between now and then, which will be, you know, sort of a decent pace, I guess, now that this first one's out. Probably the next ones might kind of feel a bit quick by comparison. But there's more than just a new character, a new stage, and new music, because you got the stage creator coming in with 3.0. Which is, you know, is something, you know, that Smash Ultimate didn't have that previous Smash games did. So yeah, well, yeah, we in particular, I remember messing around a bit with the stage creator, but obviously user generated content is kind of a synonym for mass producing fallacies, unfortunately. Yes. So yeah, I'm sure this teething problems for that kind of stuff. I've not really dipped into the submissions yet.
Right. So Nintendo in 2019 has shipped a like user creation tool that does not have kind of a report button. Like, you can't just say like, hey, this isn't appropriate, and I'm going to report the person who made this. So that's weird. How are they going to fix that, I guess?
I don't know, I've not dipped into it yet, so I've not seen like the countermeasures that they do or don't have.
Right.
I assume you've got videos as well being shared, although I had a little look because I've turned some of my replays into videos before the update would have nuked the replay data because the version of the game had changed. And, you know, I wouldn't have minded uploading some of those to something because at the moment they're just kind of stuck with me because, you know, on Wii U, you could upload them to YouTube. That was possible. But the old videos that you made, I don't think are, you know, kind of compatible with the new kind of posting and sharing system. So yeah, I guess I'll have to do more stupid stuff with the soccer ball item before I'll get to paste any videos together and post them anywhere.
So they're not, those videos are not, like, saved on an SD card. Like, you can't just take that SD card to the computer and transfer them manually.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure about that, because, like, they're not even in... Like, because obviously with outside of Smash, you know, the system level screenshot functionality and the 30-second video save, like, the 30-second video save thing doesn't work in Smash. You know, and these videos don't save like those do on the system level like album. So yeah, I have no idea if there's anything more you could do with them. But obviously, this sort of system that they're introducing with 3.0 does, you know, address this. But I guess just not for the stuff that you've already accumulated over, you know, the past few months playing the game, which is, yeah, a little bit of a shame. I've got some silly things in there. It's not all soccer balls, including quite a bizarre episode where somebody was killed, was playing with DDD in his like Game Boy kind of colouring, you know, like that sort of, you know, the same colour as the Game Boy screen palette that DDD has. And he was killed with a scythe, which is a Kid Icarus Uprising weapon that if somebody's over 100%, it's an instant kill with a smash attack. They just disappear. They don't have to be launched off the screen. So he disappears, and then somebody did a final smash on the same spot that he disappeared, and the DDD sort of model came back just frozen and incorporeal, but just there as a ghost. It was really sinister. It was like the final smash was some sort of blood magic ritual to bring him back after his death at the hands of the scythe. And that was a great thing I managed to preserve, and that would probably have been the first thing I would have posted, but no. Now I have to fucking spend too long describing it in auditory form. That's just, not the same, is it? Not the same, but still.
No.
I will be availing myself of some of these extra features. But for now, yeah, I've had a bit of time to experiment with Joker and stuff. Ran through the classic mode, which is amusing. There's some amusing touches in there that I can appreciate, even having not played Persona games, just sort of knowing about them conceptually and seeing some of the Persona 5 anime. The you kind of play against these like shadow versions of characters, so they're all in their like darkest palettes. And then like once you've beat one stage, then in the next stage they'll be on your side fighting again, you know, so like, you know, the whole, you know, Persona kind of capturing system in those games, is kind of a cute little touch, and it, you know, runs through quite a lot of the music, that they've added in the classic mode, which is 11 songs, 3 being new arrangements of songs, which is pretty good. Obviously not the explosion that like Castlevania had. But it's still pretty healthy. And something worth pointing out, I think, if you think of Bayonetta, when that was added to Wii U 3DS, the music was pretty healthy, amount of music there, but it didn't really have proper original arrangements at all. It had sort of 2, I think, that were listed as original, but they were only original in the sense that they excised the vocals from the actual songs.
Oh.
for rights versions, so yeah, right. For rights reasons, I should say, presumably. So I was a little concerned whether you'd get, you know, the sort of, whether, obviously we want, yeah, I think from these 5, the biggest kind of range of music to add to this incredible collection that Smash has already amassed. But you think of that with Bayonetta, and you also think of the Final Fantasy situation, where we got 2. You got 2 songs from Final Fantasy VII, and that was it. It wasn't a given that it would be this healthy, so that's good to see. And in particular, there are vocals in a lot of the songs, which is good, because just from seeing some of the animated show for 5, the primary vocalist associated with Persona 5, Lynn, got a great voice. It's really fun to listen to, so I'm glad that those have kind of made their way in, and you get the full kind of atmosphere of the series coming across.
Yeah, the rights thing, I mean, it's it seems like some companies are kind of like pulling all the stops. I'm not sure. You know, I can't see behind the scenes, but there's also like this this game that just came out, Super Robot Taizen. It's a long running series, and it's basically like a mishmash of mecha anime franchises.
Yeah.
I saw a scene on you. Someone posted on Twitter. They posted what happens when you use the Cowboy Bebop crew, and you've got like basically the full opening of that show playing. And it's kind of like, it's basically the only thing that they could have done, right, to represent that show, because it's so defined by its music. So, it's kind of cool to see, that kind of stuff coming from Japan, because they can be, a little bit, hesitant.
Like I said, sometimes these restrictions are hard to understand. Like, I mean, with Final Fantasy VII, why just to, you know, I mean, I can kind of understand maybe, you know, they wouldn't have wanted like bespoke arrangements for Smash, because, you know, like arranging Final Fantasy VII soundtrack is like an industry unto itself for them. You know, but why you couldn't have more than just 2 tracks from, you know, the original soundtrack, when, you know, the stage is so kind of expertly recreated from the source material, is just kind of weird to me. But there you go. I'm very glad that we haven't had the same situation with Persona, and that it really kind of all comes across. The stage, you know, they've kind of gone to additional lengths here and there, because like the stage actually changes based on which Persona game the song that's playing comes from. So the Persona games, even again, me from the outside, like I recognize that they have this like very strong color coding with their kind of aesthetic and everything. So you know, you've got the stage is all in this sort of is all in red, black and white for 5, which is sort of, to me, is the right color palette for anything that's meant to be kind of dreamlike or surreal, because it's it's the Red Room from Twin Peaks, basically. you've got the other two, you know, Persona 4 and Persona 3, in terms of games that have songs in it, are represented with like the sort of the bright yellow and bright blue palettes coming in when their songs kick in, and of course that can be, you know, handled by sort of adjusting the sliders in the My Music section for the probability of them appearing or whatever. So, you know, they've put a lot of detail and a lot of kind of effort into, you know, bringing the Persona series into the Smash fold. Even, you know, that's obvious to someone like me that doesn't get, you know, all the references or anything, I assume. For other people, it's even more rich than that. But in terms of the character, it's interesting, sort of. There's definitely some overlap with Cloud, because this sort of gauge that he fills with Cloud, you've got filling up the limit break gauge. But in his case, that is, once that's filled, you get essentially a single use supercharged special attack. Whereas in the case of Joker, he's kind of goes into a whole other sort of mode where his persona comes out and all his special attacks or everything about him is enhanced for a certain period of time until that gauge wears out again. And you know, there's some quite big differences between the special moves. You know, like for instance, his recovery move, when he's in a sort of standard form, is a grappling hook, which it's, you know, it's a pretty good recovery move. There's nothing wrong with it, and it can be used to snag people out of the air offensively. But then when he goes into, you know, the sort of persona mode, his persona can like just use this giant pair of wings to cover an enormous amount of distance, a really, really good recovery sort of move. So, you know, it's a quite a different, you know, kind of proposition at that point, you know, what it's going to take to get him out. So, like I said, there's a little bit of Cloud in terms of, you know, that meter, but it's, I guess, also a little bit reminiscent of Lucario, in terms of Lucario gets more powerful when he's at higher damage. And in this case, you can sort of juice the meter by kind of working a counter to get it going quicker, but it'll also go up quicker if you've taken damage and stuff, so you're more likely to be in this kind of souped up mode when you're getting hurt, so that it kind of naturally, you know, goes to you being able to recover better and do more damage at higher damage percentages. So it's yeah, he's a little bit like Lucario in that way, and he's definitely quicker than Cloud as well. So obviously it's so many characters now, you know, I mean, it's tough. It's tough, you know, to not have a character that kind of seems like, well, it's a bit of this character and a bit of that character, like, mashed together and kind of bolted on, because, yeah, they've gone through so many kind of permutations at this point. But between the way they kind of meld it into the sort of the fiction and the lore of the character, and then also actually doing some sort of weird combinations of attributes, they're still doing, I think, a pretty admirable job of making these characters seem distinct. And certainly if the subsequent four are as distinct as Joker is, I think they would have done a really good job. But I think that might be difficult, but we'll see, you know, depending on where they come from and everything else.
Well, at least, yeah, Joker is not a freaking sword user, right?
He has a knife. There's a little bit of that. And he also has a gun, so I guess he's prepared in either fight scenario. You know, he's never going to be embarrassed about that. But, yeah, like, his gun attack is, like, kind of quite weak in his standard sort of state, but then when he's got the persona going, it's more like Bayonetta's gun attack in terms of its usefulness. So yes, who knows how it's going to balance out. Of course, when, you know, Bayonetta came in for on Wii U and 3DS, you know, it was mass sort of complaints that she was overpowered. You know, and certainly many people who were much more capable at playing the game than I am, you know, kind of felt that it was never really properly accounted for in that game. And it only really until this one that she was brought back down to earth. So I guess we'll see how the Joker and the other DLC characters, whether they, you know, I'm sure there will be you know, some element of trial and error with getting this thing to bat. They probably put loads of effort into getting it right first time, but I'd be very surprised if it exquisitely balanced out just that first time. You've got to see it in the wild a bit.
So, do you have more to add, or should we move on to...
I think we'll proceed to your section now, shall we?
All right. So, very quickly, I got to play the demo for Box Boy plus Box Girl. I think that's the title. I've played the first game when it came out on the 3DS, and I really enjoyed it, played through the whole thing. I think I also did, like, I think that there were, like, post-credits puzzles. I think I did those. But once I was done with that, I was probably kind of done with the game. And then, they came with, came out with a sequel. There were two sequels on the 3DS, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it was another box, I want to say. and then
I lose track.
And then the Sayonara Box Boy that we sort of refer to.
Bye bye, Box Boy.
Yeah.
So I bought the first sequel and then I never really touched it, unfortunately. And, it's weird because I think that, it took me a while before I got the Switch and, I was still playing my 3DS and I was trying to play through like the backlog I had for the Wii U.
Yeah.
So I held off and, I saw people online saying like, why are these games still coming out for 3DS? I don't want to go back to it ever. The Switch is out. It's new and I want games for it. And, I always had, I will admit that I tended to judge those people for abandoning the 3DS so quickly. But then the same thing kind of happened to me,
you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Exactly. So as I was kind of finishing up the games that I had started before buying the Switch, I found myself not really starting new ones, and just, you know, purchasing and enjoying games on the Switch instead. So I think that some of that contributed to me not actually playing the sequel for Box Boy. And then not really paying attention at all to the third game. This was announced pretty recently for the Switch and it's coming out. I think it's out now. It's out in April anyway. The demo is out.
Yeah, so I think it's the 26th or so. Okay. For when it fully comes out, at least in a region, possibly.
Okay.
Possibly
so
here.
The demo came out 1 week ahead of the full game. Okay. So I'm playing the demo, and I'm realizing that it's kind of uncanny how appealing an HD Box Boy is. I did not expect that, but it looks, you know, really, it looks nice in HD. There's nothing to the graphics, right? Like it's just a white square on a white background with black outline.
It could have worked as a Game Boy game.
Like, oh yeah,
and I think there was some kind of content in Sayonara Box Boy or whatever it was that actually did put a Game Boy aesthetic on it. I don't know whether it was if you scanned one of the Kirby amiibo or a bonus world or something, but it basically turned it into, you know, a Game Boy aesthetic.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, I mean, it's always been super simple, but it's so clean looking. It's fine to see it. You know, it still works, you know, when taken to a larger and sharper screen.
Yeah, and like my TV is much brighter than the 3DS screen can ever be, and it looks nice. So I was a little bit surprised by that. The demo is just the first world, so it's basically you go through the tutorial, so there's not really any surprises if you have played a Box Boy game before, and if you haven't, then it teaches you what these games are like, and I think it's pretty good representation.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because I think when the third Game Boy, when the third 3DS iteration of Box Boy came out, what they did was like a sort of omnibus demo. So they had a demo that kind of incorporated the different like gimmicks that were particular to each installment. So you could kind of, it was kind of a demo for all three games. And so that's all I've played of Box Boy. But even having just played that, this demo was like retreading a fair bit of the same ground, you know.
Right. It teaches you the basic of how to produce a box out of your body, which is like the whole gameplay here. You've got to solve these puzzles to get through these levels. You kind of extend a box out of your box-like body, and you can use that in different ways. You can just create a box and then just drop it and then jump on top of it to, you know, to jump higher to clear an obstacle. You can create a platform for yourself over some spikes. You can create steps, you know, stairs. You can create like a kind of a roof over your head to protect yourself from some, you know, deadly rays, some electricity. Then like it gets into like some weirder uses, like, you can extend that in like an opening. And then if you press the Y button again, which you were holding to, the Y button has multiple uses, but like when you've extended yourself through like this really tight opening, then you press the Y button again and you just kind of, get pulled to the other extremity of the series of boxes that you created. And so you kind of like snake around. So there's like it's really like they get really inventive. And, the one new ability that I don't think was in the first game that I saw in this demo is that you can just like shoot forward, your boxes that you created. And, that comes into play in various ways, usually to kind of like to hit buttons that are at the other end of, a chasm, to make like platforms appear to be anyway. So there's some new stuff here, but you just get to see like one new mechanic basically in this demo. Like at least it gives you a good idea of what the game looks like. And if you've never played a Box Boy game, it gives you a good idea of what it plays like. And also it's got a co-op mode. So, you know, you can choose a tail for one, but there's also a tail for two. Karen was a little bit busy tonight, so she came in late. So, I had to rush through the co-op mode with her. She was good enough to play with me, on a schedule. The demo for two players, first of all, to my surprise, I then realized that you can play by yourself. You can control both characters. If you're planning to play this game by yourself and you never, you know, choose that icon, choose that mode, even just to look at it, you might miss that fact.
Content that you could experience in some capacity.
Yeah. So in the initial levels, demo levels for the two-player mode are very similar to the single-player demo levels, in that they just teach you basic stuff like how to jump and how to create boxes. But then it gets into more, a little bit more complex puzzles, although not too much. But they do make use of the fact that as Box Boy, you can only create one set of boxes. When you've created a set of boxes and you've dropped them somewhere, when you try to create a second set of boxes, the first one disappears. And so a lot of the puzzles in the demo levels for two players is getting around that. You know, like I'm creating these stairs to get up here, but they're standing on spikes and I need to create like the second set of boxes. And I can't do that because the floor is going to disappear under my feet and I'm going to fall on those spikes. But the second player can create like the whatever structure that you need. And so like you have to collaborate and like kind of alternate between, the sets of structures that you want to create. And of course, like there are also segments where like, okay, the first player takes like the upper path and the second player takes the bottom path, and each has like these buttons that they have to press to let the other person through, like to open up a gate to let the other person through so that they can reach this button that will let you through. and stuff like that.
I've not played this, but just from sort of seeing some of it on video, some of the co-op stuff that they've added to Captain Toad seems quite similar to that, but you know, obviously in that kind of 3D diorama setting.
Yeah. So it's nothing that, you know, mind blowing, but I'll take it because I do like co-op games, and Karen seemed to be won over by the little dances that Box Boy and Box Girl do when you finish a stage. You know, it's a very charming game. Like we've said that it looks very simplistic, but it packs a lot of personality for a game that looks this basic.
It's minimalist. In its endearing qualities, but I guess it still manages it. I mean, one thing I took from this demo, kind of reminding me of playing the previous one as well, is I think it's really a good use of kind of in terms of replay incentives to have the whole kind of box efficiency system, you know, in terms of getting medals for clearing the tasks with you know, a certain number of boxes used. Obviously with the really simplistic tasks, it's, you know, pretty much, you know, it's really obvious like how many, you know, that would be needed. So if you're going to clear it at all, you're going to reach that requirement. But with more sophisticated puzzles, I think you know, that's where it could get really kind of that sort of extra layer of fiendishness for people who want it, of like, okay, well, I've come up with a solution to this just to clear it, but in terms of how could I do it using just this many boxes, it's probably going to require, you know, another kind of leap of logic. And it kind of reminds me of stuff like Mario and Donkey Kong, Mario versus Donkey Kong games, you know, where if you're going to do the gold medal, you know, and all that kind of stuff, like you're going to have to solve it a hell of a lot more efficiently, you know, that kind of replay value and those kinds of tiers of achievement that Nintendo are really good at, or, you know, in this case, HAL, at sort of putting into their, you know, puzzle platformy kind of things. I think it's a nice way of keeping the game accessible enough for people who just want to run through it, by while giving it a bit more substance for others who, you know, really get into it.
Yeah, in the single player, like the trying to use as few boxes as possible seemed to translate into taking riskier jumps. You know, like, oh, I could create two boxes here to close this gap fully, but I could also create just one box and just make sure that I don't miss when I land.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's not just like the devising it from a puzzle point of view, but it's actually like, okay, you know, you're going to need to be more skillful on the platformer side.
Yeah, and then like in two player, like you can also do some more creative stuff, like you learn some tricks, right? Like, because as long as you don't throw out, like as long as you're producing the boxes and you don't let go of the Y button, you haven't produced the boxes. Like they don't count towards your total. You could like resorb them and they won't count. So what you can do is basically like, okay, Karen, just like jump on top of my character and I'm just going to crank you up to that crown up there and then, you know, get you back down. And we got this crown for free, basically.
Yeah.
Without using any moves. So no, it's neat. It's a good, I definitely recommend checking out the demo if you haven't already. All right. So what is your next piece of new business, Greg?
First thing I'll go with in this block is a little note on Blaster Master Zero 2. Obviously, I kind of addressed it you know, at reasonable length a few weeks ago, but I did want to follow up just kind of there is a sort of fairly substantial kind of end game behind a kind of false or bad ending, I enjoyed it, I've just kind of extended my feelings on the game overall for the most part, that I really did like it, and it did address a lot of you know, kind of the drawbacks that I kind of the first Blaster Master Zero, which I still really liked even then, but you know, having more bosses in the tank and you're kind of freshening up the top-down stuff, you know, did help make for an even more enjoyable game this time. The other thing though that it did kind of solidify for me in this end game portion is that if they were to do another one, the one thing that sort of left on the to-do list for kind of things that could use with sprucing up, based on kind of going back to, you know, the original formula really of Blastermaster, is the sort of getting out of the tank in the side-scrolling mode. Could be somewhat akin to kind of Morph Ball in Metroid, or the kind of drone thing that you have in Axiom Verge. But here, and it's in the original Zero, it's like pretty faithful to what it was like in the original Blaster Master. So like, it, you die if you fall a certain distance, you know, you can't really do a lot. There's just like this, there's this one optional like item sort of a side questy kind of planetoid that involves a mechanic from the first Blaster Master Zero, where you're just like leaping from ladder to ladder in the sort of small, you know, bipedal mode, and oof, yeah, that was never good. And it's just like, yeah, it just feels like they could use with finding something interesting to do with that, because it is featured a bit, you know. It's not as if they kind of just ignore that aspect of, you know, just like, oh, you're always in the tank or whatever. You know, they do try and work it in a bit. Like I said, I think primarily kind of vestigial, you know, kind of being faithful to the way Blaster Master was originally, but they just haven't come up with anything interesting to do with it, which you can do. You know, I mean, I think you look at, you know, where Morph Ball stuff has got taken over time, where it's the way you add like Spider Ball to it, or all these like puzzles you can do with it and stuff. Like it's very different from regular gameplay, and it can kind of, you know, I mean, the biggest part of it, the fundamental part of it is, you know, you kind of, there's some sort of trade off of like, okay, you kind of sacrifice some of your mobility or your power to fit into these little spaces, but you know, you need to make it feel like a trade-off that doesn't suck for it to be fun. I mean, you know, and there's an art to doing that. We've spoken about it with Robobot in terms of, you know, like that is a trade-off in a way, but it doesn't feel like it because you're in a giant mech and you're kicking the shit out of everything. It's, it glosses over the fact that there's a trade-off there. And like Blaster Master Zero to when you're out of the tank is like the exact opposite of that. Like it's kind of to some extent intentionally, like you know, you're supposed to feel vulnerable out of the tank and you're not very capable and it's just for these like very particular tasks. But I think, especially with the amount of time that's spent in the end game in that setting, it kind of begs for more unique mechanics and interesting kind of design that would make the trade-off feel more worthwhile than it is. Like I said, I think in Axiom Verge, yeah, that had a pretty good way of, you know, having something that was like the Morph Ball but not exactly the same, and the way it kind of evolved as you upgraded it and stuff had a kind of kind of unique flavor to it, and did some cool things with that concept. So maybe if there were a sequel to Blaster Master Zero 2, that is something they could work on, because it's pretty well polished in most other respects. Now, moving on to a few retro-related things that have come up just recently. We had the full lineup for the Castlevania Collection that Konami announced at the same time that we had the first of their anniversary collections, the sort of arcade one, actually launched.
Yeah, let me tell you, I looked at the arcade classics and I said to myself, you know what, I'm good.
Do you like shoot 'em ups? That's the only question you have to ask yourself. Because
the ones that are not shoot 'em up are freaking terrible.
Haunted Castle, I think, is the only non shoot 'em up, isn't it? And yeah, that's got a terrible reputation. And I've got the collection today. I've not gone into Haunted Castle yet to verify that it's really terrible or anything, but yeah, that's not what I bought it for, that's for sure. I mean, it's not a terrible value proposition over here in terms of 8 games for £16 And, you know, so a couple quid a piece.
It's like $25 Canadian dollars or probably $19.99 in the US.
In the US, it is. And it's a bit premium in Japan. It's like 3,000 some odd yen for some reason. But, the couple quid a game's not bad, even if the Haunted Castle is seemingly not worth £2. But, there's a immediately disappointing aspect to it, though. In that there's a number of vertical games here, and there is no vertical display mode, so that you could put it in flip grip per sort of usage, which is odd because it is Hamster that's doing this, who I've already played some of their arcade archive games in a flip grip. And it is very explicitly on one of the menu screens says powered by Arcade Archives with their logo on it, a bit of cross promotion, basically. So it's odd. And in many respects, it's like very, very similar to their Arcade Archives releases. The bloody sound effects are the same and all sorts of stuff on the menus. But then, that you don't have that option. That's weird. It's not something, I guess, that's really going to come into play for the Castlevania collection. But it is an issue with Contra, because that the arcade Contras, I think Contra and Super Contra, were both vertical.
Oh.
So that would also be a shame if it's not the case there. I mean, given that Hamster have done so much stuff with that Tate kind of support, it's hard to imagine that it's an oversight and that it would just get added later. It just kind of smacks of some sort of mandate for feature, kind of equality across, because this is not just on Switch, it's on PS4, whatever,
Right. I was just going to go with the explanation that at this point, Konami's video game business is animated by spite more than anything else.
That they're opening up, and there's some nice elements to this. It's not just kind of a slightly subpar Arcade Archives anthology, because there is like a supplemental material section where it goes into the sort of Switch web browser that you're not allowed to use outside of the eShop and a few other things, you can kind of read through this digital book of supplemental material where you've got scans of sketches of enemy designs, character designs, level designs, scans of the artwork, the flyers for the arcade games. They've got a timeline of all the arcade games that Konami released from 1981 up through 1989, which is sort of where the scope of this particular collection ends. So that obviously gives you a sense of this is 8 releases, but there were many more releases across that time span, and where these kind of fit in. Which is mostly 1988. I think 4 of them come from that year for whatever reason. Obviously, some of the other ones that are listed here will appear, the Contra, Super Contra will appear on that Contra collection, and they've said there'll be more, so who knows whether there'll be further, kind of games plucked from that time span for later. But, that kind of extra context and all that kind of stuff is a nice bonus, to make it feel, more than just a bunch of arcade ROMs kind of thrown together. And if you, if you're a big Gradius fan, like I said, there's a fair bit to like here. We've got the original Gradius, you've got his forerunner in Scramble, you've got the spin-off in Life Force, and then you've got the sequel, of Gradius 2, which I played a fair bit of back on Wii Virtual Console with the PC Engine /TurboGrafx CD conversion, which was regarded as a relatively top-notch conversion back then, but having something that's pretty much spot on to the arcade of that is pretty cool, and having it on Switch as well is just something that I'm very interested in. I had a checkered past with playing shoot 'em ups on portable devices like PSP or DS or something, because not that great shoot 'em ups anyway, but apparently when you shrink the screen size, I get even worse. But I think Switch's screen size in portable mode is big enough that it's not a big problem, and of course you can put it on the TV. So yeah, that's
right.
It's a pretty sweet way to play shoot 'em ups, and I'm kind of amassing quite a few of them, even though I can't really keep up with all the ones that are coming out. Like there's more that I'd like to play. So yeah, I mean, apart from the misses of having the Tarte mode, it seems pretty nice playing. I've just dipped into the Gradius games on there and they seem to play pretty well. I can't really report anything seeming too out of whack at this point, because sometimes with emulation, you know, you get these kinds of input lags or something's just wrong, you know, even if you don't really have the most like razor sharp perception, like something feels off. But I guess, you know, with the arcade archives and all that, you'd think Hamster are practiced enough to get that stuff right, and for the most part they seemingly have. But I'm looking forward to Castlevania, which will be 4 weeks time, I guess. Mm-hmm. Castlevania, we know the extra 4 slots now, and so Bloodlines is coming in, not surprisingly, I guess, after it's been on the Mega Drive Mini.
Right. Yeah.
Simon's Quest and Castlevania the Adventure are both also coming in, which is weird because we were saying, like, oh, these two seem like they've been passed over when they weren't in the original 4, because yeah, we had the second Castlevania for Game Boy, and then we had Castlevania 1 and Castlevania 3, but not 2. So it kind of seemed like maybe, well, they wouldn't be making up the final 4, but no, they are.
I guess they didn't want to reveal all the games at once, but also it would have been boring to, like, oh, we're revealing that all the NES games are coming out.
It's they just kind of wanted to mix it up, I guess. But the surprise is Kid Dracula. That is, and it's the Famicom Kid Dracula. So Kid Dracula is known best as a Game Boy game because it was on Famicom and Game Boy, but only the Game Boy one got out of Japan.
Yeah.
And this appears to be just the Famicom version, which had not been seen outside of Japan. It was not on Virtual Console, nor was the Game Boy version on Virtual Console either. So really happy that something a bit more obscure. And it's kind of a super late Famicom game. I think it was
It's localized, right?
I'm not sure what the deal is with that.
I think I saw Chris Kohler on Twitter. He seemed to imply or to say that, yeah, it would be a new translation.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine there would have been a great deal of work needed to make that happen, because, you know, I'm not sure if it'd be on, like, the Game Boy version was translated and, you know, ready to play in the West, and I don't think there's a great deal of, you know, text or anything like that, but it's still cool that it's happening. And I've never played any version of it as much as I would have liked to, so it's great that I'll get a chance to do that. It would have been even nicer if they'd had the Game Boy version too, but you know, because I don't think it's strictly like a port. It's somewhat remixed, you know, as was generally the case for these sorts of junior versions, so we say, of Famicom or NES games coming to Game Boy. Obviously, as you'd expect, like the character seems a bit bigger on screen and stuff like that, but I do think they changed levels and some aspects of something about mini games, and there was definitely some changes made to the Game Boy game beyond just adapting it. So it would have been nice to see it kind of complete, like all the different versions of it, but it doesn't seem like we're going to be quite getting that comprehensive. But to have that and Bloodlines is great. I guess the one thing you can say is that it is missing Rondo of Blood, but it is possible that Rondo of Blood could be, you know, sort of sandwiched in with a symphony on a subsequent collection because of its, even though it's a different style of Castlevania, it's connected by story and all that stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I wouldn't give up hope for that being part of one of the subsequent collections that they've hinted at, but it's not strictly linear action Castlevanias here because Simon's Quest is on it.
So, just going back to the Konami Arcade Collection, I've got a question. So, this is not by Digital Eclipse, it's by Hamster.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Greg, you're a fan of shooters, and you're good at them, and you're willing to put in the time to get good at them.
Not that good, but not good enough to be like actually proficient enough to necessarily be able to get that far into every kind of shooter. I mean, it depends like how they structure in terms of checkpoints and continues and stuff, but I like them, that's for damn sure.
So for someone who like me has described himself as a tourist of shooters who just likes to see the explosions and the moai heads and is not necessarily willing to put in the time to get good at them. Does this have any kind of cheating options at all, like rewind features or save states?
Yeah, I mean, saves it has. It's kind of seems pretty simple in terms of like a single save spot, unlike, something that the Sega Ages, M2 ones, like if you had Thunder Force 4, for instance, that's got multiple slots that you can save from, and it's got like a kids mode, and it's got loads of stuff, but not the rewind, though. I think that is just that is something that Digital Eclipse, has had various things, but I don't know whether anybody else has quite gone that far. And Super Nintendo Mini had it, of course, as well, which was neat. You can configure the difficulty. Yeah, there's a difficulty configuration on the games that I've seen, and there's a save state that you can make. It's not just an interrupt the way that the Wii Virtual Console was. It's more than that, but the rewind kind of thing, or like the SNK collection by Digital Eclipse actually just sort of lets you watch a playthrough and then come in at any point you want, and you could really be a tourist there, kind of like, okay, let's just I fancy taking the wheel here, let's see how this goes, kind of thing. I mean, that is a great feature. It would be nice if, more retro stuff had features like that. But, it's basically Arcade Archives, except without Tartane mode for the vertical ones. That is, if you've had any of the Arcade Archives games, you've got a pretty good sense of the features that are present here.
Yeah. All right. Well, my final bit of new business tonight is I've played a little bit of Dragon Quest Builders. So this is not a new Switch game. It came out quite early on in the system's life.
Yeah, the sequel obviously is coming, this year.
Yeah, in June, I think, or July. So it's coming out soon, and it's supposed to have like a number of improvements, right? But I on this podcast, I've said people know that I've been taking games from the library, and this is a game that I think I was supposed to get much earlier, but I think that in their database, I must have had like a bad entry or something, and so I reserved it and never got it, and then I realized, oh wait, there's a second entry, and I reserved it, and I got it like a month later. So I'm playing it very late, not by choice, but this made me kind of realize that maybe I should stop getting library loans for games, because I, at this point, like the initial idea was that, well, I'm going to save some money by, playing through the games that I can, and maybe like just kind of sampling games before I buy them.
Sure. Yeah.
But I don't need that at this point, because I've already purchased more games than I can play. So, Dragon Quest Builders, like I've had for the last month, and I've put in maybe 5 hours in it, which is not a whole lot. And it's not because I don't find it fun, because I do. So I'm Yeah, it's just that at this point, like, I've got other things to keep me busy. And so, yeah, I didn't need another, like, 50, 60, 70 hours long game to play at this moment. And not in the foreseeable future. I'm stocked on those already. So, but I played the first 5 hours. There is a demo for this game. I could probably gotten out the same impressions from the demo than I did from the what I played the full game, because as far as I know, the demo is just the beginning of the game. But I had held off playing the demo because I had read that the your progress didn't transfer over to the full game. Yeah. So, so yeah, so the first 5 hours, I was pleasantly surprised because I am not a Minecraft fan. I've never played it. I've seen Karen's nephew play it for a little bit. I didn't really feel tempted to, you know, grab the controller and give it a shot or to have him like show me the stuff that he built or guide me through the game. Like I was utterly uninterested because I think mainly because Minecraft kind of looks like vomit to me.
I can't say as it's ever struck me as terribly appealing from a visual point of view, but
right,
it's whether you're talking about Minecraft or Builders 2. I mean, the one thing I will say from my point of view is that I've been kind of before it's just something I'd rule out entirely because right. Only in portable play could I envision this being something I could really kind of get my teeth into eventually. Sure. And I will see how, you know, Builders 2 is received, because I'm somewhat interested in that at this juncture. But I did ever get round to downloading the demo of first Builders to give it a good shot.
I think you should. I was pleasantly surprised, as I said. Because I think that the nicer art style, because yeah, Minecraft doesn't look like anything.
It has like an art style, yeah.
Sure,
but that helps. First,
yeah, exactly. Like Minecraft is just like it's pixelated, but I don't see a purpose to it. Like it doesn't look retro. Doesn't look great. Like it, and the zombies, the green dudes, look like giant walking dildos. Like
it's only ever looked utilitarian to me, which is fine. I mean, you know, in terms of like that's what, you know, kind of the game was about, was more about play than, you know, about aesthetics. And obviously, it's become so popular that you know the utilitarian aesthetic has kind of become ubiquitous, you know, around products and stuff. You know, even though I've never played the game, I've seen plenty of it because its presence is so great. But I think that's more a function of how much people have taken to playing the game than, you know, because of the aesthetics in themselves.
Right. So Dragon Quest Builders is just like blocks, right? Visibly, everything in the world is just building blocks put together, and but they've got a nice texture applied to them, and so, you know, that makes all the difference. The characters look, you know, like Dragon Quest characters. It's very appealing. The monsters, of course, probably I like the monster design in Dragon Quest better than the character design.
Sure.
And they're all there. All your, you know, the friendly slimes and the drakies and the chimeras, like. Anyway, those are the initial enemies that I encountered, the Ammerhoods. They're all here, and you fight them, and you collect, resources that you then can put together, craft new items, new weapons. It is Minecraft. It is a ripoff, you know, like it is, you're building like maybe not a pickaxe, but a sword or a hammer or, you know, tools that you're going to use to extract more resources from the world. You're going to create torches to keep enemies away. You're going to build like, you know, a little house for yourself with a door, as a place to sleep in to, you know, during the night to avoid like hordes of monsters and to, you know, recuperate your health and, all that stuff. So it is Minecraft, but it is a more mission-based and guided experience, which is the second thing that I like about Dragon Quest Builders over Minecraft. It's that it's not just throwing you into a world and like, okay, this is like your sandbox. Go be creative. Make your own fun. To me, make your own fun sounds like work. It's like, well, you should be making my fun. I should not have to make it for myself. What is
yeah,
this?
Yeah, I think that's definitely... I mean, well, I probably was never the sort of kid that was that desperate to make his own fun, but
right.
I certainly would have been more receptive to that idea as a child than right. I am today.
After 30 years of video games killing off your creativity.
and everything else. like, yeah, it's a lot more like you're just you expect the media to do the heavy lifting at this point.
Yeah, so yeah, same world. So it's more structured and like you'll have characters asking you to, put some put four walls together and put a door and create a bed and create a room for them, and they'll basically give you quests to create all the items that you'll need to get further into the game, further into your quests. Create a better crafting table, create this, first a chest to put your items in, but then like an even better chest, which warps your weapons around or your items that you pick up around. And so you don't have to really think about, emptying and kind of like readjusting your on-person inventory all the time. So it's got this nice structure, this nice kind of progression to it. There were a few things that annoyed me towards the end. Like I went to rescue this person to add him to my town, and I had to kind of climb down a big mountain to go get him. And when you go get him, he says, like, well, if you have, like, a Chimera wing, that would be nice. We could just use it to warp back to town. I did not have a Chimera wing to warp back to town. And the Chimeras that you can harvest, Chimera feathers from were on the other side of the freaking map. And
just,
so I
just,
had to...
Just rubbing it in at that point, didn't they?
Yeah, so if I had known... I would have brought one with me when I went to get this dude, but I didn't. So it was like trek all the way to the where those enemies are, farm Chimera feathers, and then go back to the dude and then warp back to town and then finally complete the quest. So that was a little bit annoying. Eventually the gameplay loop of getting harvesting resources and crafting items gets repetitive no matter how many new items that you get to create. So I'm not sure if I, especially wanted to be playing this for hours and hours and hours. But I did enjoy the 5 hours or so that I played it more than I thought I would. And a lot of that is kind of the Dragon Quest coding. And the more appealing visuals and the more structured mission design. So yeah, give the demo a shot, I guess, is what I'm saying, if you haven't already. And if you like it, then wait until June or July for the sequel, which is supposed to be better.
Yeah, it's been out in Japan for a bit, hasn't it, the sequel?
I think so, yeah. And I think that I've seen a report from... this journalist I follow, Nadia Oxford, I think she said that the sequel seemed to have issues running on Switch that the original didn't have. And that's one thing that kind of impressed me, I guess, about the Switch version of the first game. It's very, very smooth, undocked or docked. So that's a little bit concerning, I guess, about the sequel. But other than that, it seems like the sequel is better regarded. I guess people can wait and see. But in the meantime, there's a demo for the first one. So I think that will be it for the recording tonight. One short segment. I didn't really have time to edit this weekend, and everyone is away, and James is studying the Bible, and but we still wanted to give our listeners something to listen to during church. So, yeah. So, Greg, what is the music? I know that normally I would have said that people need to write to rfn@nintendowordreport.com, but I forgot. But now it's done. So, Greg.
Yes.
What is the music?
Yeah, I went for a 2-for-1 here because on the one hand, we've got the news that Kid Dracula is coming back. And then on the other hand, we've got the fact that the day that this podcast will go up, the 21st, presumably, anyway, of April, is the 30th anniversary of the Game Boy in Japan. Which, is, you know, it's a pretty major milestone. Kid Dracula on Game Boy is not an especially early game, actually. It was, you know, it was a few years into the life of the system by that point, but it's quite emblematic of a lot of the things, you know, that were on Game Boy in terms of kind of taking series or, you know, indeed in this case, kind of an actual game that was on Famicom and kind of adapting them to the Game Boy format. A lot of times, you know, it did kind of involve having to have a sort of expressive character on there that sometimes took too much space up on the constrained resolution of the screen and all that. But I mean, even just the whole concept of Kid Dracula, the sort of junior version, the more sort of cheerful, somewhat of a, you know, kind of parody thing. There was a lot of that on Game Boy, you know, trying to sort of adapt to, you know, what the Game Boy could do and the sort of market they were aiming for with it. But by all accounts, Kid Dracula is, you know, a very good sort of exponent of that kind of formula in terms of, you know, actually ends up being a sort of a really quite fun game. Obviously, I'll get to put that to the test with the Famicom version, you know, in a few weeks or whatever on that Castlevania collection. But here I've got a song from the Game Boy soundtrack, yeah, showing off that Game Boy sound that this very much, again, kind of represents well, which is from the sort of first level clock tower sort of section, you know, where it's very sort of directly referencing, kind of spoofing Castlevania. And even in the song choice, this is a sort of, you know, kind of goofy and upbeat remix of beginning the first level theme from Castlevania 3. you know, so it's a kind of fun take on, not that you couldn't do sort of more traditional Castlevania music well on Game Boy, because certainly Belmont's Revenge, which will also be seen on that collection, has got great music that's pretty much, you know, in the traditional Castlevania vein, but this is more in the sort of goofy Konami parodious mode, and it's a lot of fun. And unfortunately, these days, Konami's descents into self-parody usually involve how they treat their employees or something, rather than fun video games.
Yeah, so you said the 21st is the 30th anniversary?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, so I might put this out on Friday on the feed. So if you're listening to this before the 21st, you're not allowed to listen to this music.
Wait
a couple of days.
If you do, it'll be like feeding the gremlins after midnight or whatever. It's bad, right? Things will happen.
So please wait a couple of days before finishing this podcast. But yeah, in the meantime, thank you, Greg, for being here.
Yes, I will be out next week for my annual draft watching. So
that's right.
I'll be back with you the week after that. My own personal journey into baseless hype. as we've discussed recently on the show, I will be living it next week.
A religious experience of a kind.
Yeah. Oh, very much so.
Yes. So it's not going to be a full crew next week. We'll see what happens, but hopefully there will be more than two people showing up, and James will be there, and probably John, and I'll be there. Most important. So see you next week, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.